members of the Commonwealth Club, and guests. Our speaker, Dr. Russell Lee, is known to a good many of you. I'll wait just a moment. I don't think this loudspeaker is on. There we go. Does that go?
I think after it's settled, they can hear you pretty well, even if it's off.
Our speaker, Dr. Russell Lee, is known to a great many of you. To those of you who don't know him, I may say that he's a top-notch doctor, and that in addition, he is a man of very broad attainments and abilities which range from public-spirited work in philanthropy to good poker playing. As to the latter, I say that with good authority, although fortunately not from personal experience. Dr. Lee is a Palo Altan and is one of the founders of the Palo Alto Clinic, which has been a successful pioneer in its field. He was also, prior to entering in the Army, a teacher in the Stanford Medical School. A few years ago, after returning from a trip to Sweden, Dr. Lee was instrumental in launching the drive in the West Coast to control venereal disease through public education. His record in the Army Medical Services has been outstanding. He was head of the Air Base Hospital at Santa Ana, and following that made a tour of the Pacific for the Army, visiting all of the base hospitals in the fronts there. He's also had a good deal to do with the development of the remarkable insecticide, DDT. His rare personal character has made him a vital friend to a great many persons. It's a privilege to introduce to the Commonwealth Club Colonel Russell V. Lee, Deputy Chief of the Bureau of Preventive Medicine of the Army Air Services. Colonel Lee.
Mr. Chairman, gentlemen, I certainly regard it as a privilege to have the opportunity of talking to the Commonwealth Club on military medicine as an Army doctor. I think I should truly say, however, that in spite of 3.5 years in the Army, I don't regard myself as an Army officer. I still regard myself as a civilian and a country doctor. And I might say, incidentally, that most of my military associates share that viewpoint. I get in some serious difficulties from my lack of militarization at various times. I think this lack of successful militarization probably depends on the fact that military service is really distasteful to me, as it is, I believe, to all doctors. Just as war is abhorrent to us, the very antithesis of life-saving to which we're supposed to be devoted doesn't appeal to the doctors in general. That may be one of the reasons why doctors sometimes show a certain amount of what they call in the Army simple adult maladjustment to military affairs. It's, however, particularly poignant in my case because I went to Stanford in the days of David Starr Jordan, when he was the great apostle of peace. And I believed in him at that time. I can remember so well, 31 years ago, September, just about this time of the month, when I was a freshman at Stanford, David Starr Jordan came back from Europe. He had been over there for 6 months for the Carnegie Peace Foundation. And of course, we were all anxious to see what he would say. A big joke on him, the war had started. And he got up, but I can see him still with his great booming voice, said, "My dear students, I've just returned from Europe where I've been for 6 months on a mission of peace." And we all tittered a little bit. He said, "I've been so far successful that the whole of Europe, with the exception of Italy, and she soon will be, are at war." Said, "We were not successful. We were merely right." I believed he was right then. I still believe he was right. I never forget, and I won't cease to resent the little group of willful men that spoiled that bright dream of world peace that so many young men of our generation at that time really believed in. That was the foundation of my pacifism. In spite of that, after I came back from a visit to Japan and Germany a few years ago, I was convinced that war was impending, and the pacifist Lee became an interventionist. As a matter of fact, a good many of my friends called me a warmonger. And then war actually came upon us, and there was nothing for me to do in justification of my previous position but to go to war. So I found myself 3.5 years ago a sort of an army doctor, at any rate a country doctor in uniform. I must say, I said before that military service is distasteful to me. It was, and it still is. In spite of that, I rejoice in the fact that I've had an opportunity to serve in this war. Not only because I've seen a divided nation gird up its loins and become the greatest military force that the world has ever known, and not only because I've not only because of that, but I've seen my own profession serve with a competence and a devotion that is a true inspiration. It has been an example that I will never forget, in spite of the great difficulties under which they labored. Now, any appraisal of the role of the Army doctor, which I were going to try to do in this war, actually demands some appraisal of the role of the medical department in the Army. The role of the medical department in this Army has to be compared with what it was in previous armies and in other wars. Actually, the history of medicine in war is a very horrible one. War and pestilence from time immemorial went hand in hand. Soldiers were supposed to be sick, and soldiers were supposed to die of disease. And as they went through a country, pestilence followed them. It's not a very nice history. I must say, in all candor, our own medical history, as far as the medical department of the Army is concerned in days gone by, has been something less than distinguished. In the Revolutionary War, surgeons were furnished the Army by the colonies. Their first loyalty was not to the Army or to the country, but to the colonies. They had no regular military appointments, and when they got a little bit piqued, they picked up their marbles and went home. And they left the soldiers frequently and most of the time without any medical attendance. I'm not at all sure, but what that was one of the unfortunate situations, however. Some of the peculiar medical procedures of that day were probably, soldiers were probably better off if they didn't receive them. However, the War of 1812 came along, and we practically had no medical service of consequence at all, just as we had very little of an army, if the truth were told, for a long while. The war with Mexico, the medical experiences of that war were perfectly dreadful. There were medical men attached as regimental surgeons. There was no system of evacuation, no field hospitals, and no medical personnel. The doctors attached to General Scott's army had to trust to the hostlers and the band to do the medical service in time of casualties. The campaign was carried on in an unhealthy tropical climate with complete disregard to even the primitive empirical public health knowledge we had at that time. And the appalling result was that General Scott lost 1/3 of his soldiers from disease in that war. They took the soldiers into Veracruz over the protest of the medical department, and they got riddled with yellow fever. Then they sent them home with yellow fever in the incubation period and planted yellow fever in a lot of the port areas of the United States, and we had that problem for a while. Came along the Civil War. Things were not much better, but they got a great deal better. The first glimmerings of a really intelligent Army medical policy began then. Letterman, after whom our local general hospital was named, was a young surgeon in the Army of the Potomac. He went to work and developed the horse-drawn ambulance evacuation system for the Army, developed something like field hospitals. He happened to have an exceedingly foresighted surgeon general over him, Hammond, after whom the general hospital at Modesto is named, and he supported him thoroughly. By the time the war was over, they had something like a reasonable medical service. The medical practices of that army were pretty dreadful, of course, and medical science hadn't advanced to the point where it was a great deal of help. I recall in that connection a letter my father showed me that his father had given him. My great-grandfather was a doctor, and his son went to the Civil War. He gave him this letter along with a bottle of laudanum. And the letter said, "My boy, if you get shot through the arms or the chest or the legs, stick it out and do the best you can. You may get well. But if you get shot through the belly, just drink this bottle of laudanum." He knew perfectly well that in those days a belly wound was fatal. And of course, the stench of hospital gangrene from the hospitals of the Civil War can still be smelled in certain areas of the eastern countryside. In the period between the Civil War, however, and the Spanish War, all the organization and all the lessons that we learned in the Civil War were lost. That usually happens both not only with the medical department, but with the Army in general. We quickly demobilize, and then we have to do it all over again next time. Hammond made a number of very fine suggestions, only one of which was taken up. That was 31 years after he made it. They founded the Army Medical School in 1893. That was about the only achievement of that period between the two wars. The foundation of that school was a distinct advance, but the Spanish War came upon us. We had 190 doctors in the Army, and we had 100 hospital stewards were authorized by Act of Congress. When the war actually broke out, they very grudgingly raised that ante to 200 hospital stewards. Well, many of you remember the horrible medical scandals of the Spanish War. The deaths from disease were far greater than the deaths from wounds. It became actually a national scandal. The Dodge Commission was appointed by President McKinley to investigate the matter, and they conducted a very thorough investigation of all phases of Army medicine and came up with a number of good recommendations. In addition to which, they had Surgeon General O'Reilly, who was quite a fellow, and he had some good ideas of his own. So they went to work and reorganized the whole medical department. The principal achievement of that period was the organization of the Medical Officers Reserve Corps. It was very difficult then to get any doctors into the regular Army establishment, but a number of the most prominent doctors in the country joined the Medical Officers Reserve Corps, and they were followed by a number of the younger doctors. As a result of that, there was built up quite a sizable Medical Officers Reserve Corps by the time World War came upon us. When World War, we had a little warning. The European War was on for a couple of years before we got in. A civilian outfit had a lot to do with our preparations for that war. A group of doctors met in Chicago quite voluntarily and founded the Medical Preparedness Committee. They approached the War Department and offered to make a survey of the country's medical facilities, their doctors and personnel and so forth, to see if they would be acceptable to the Army. They adopted those suggestions, and in addition to that, then the Council of National Defense was set up. Dr. Frederick Martin, who founded the College of Surgeons, was put in charge of that committee. He got a very strong committee with the Surgeon General of the Army and the Surgeon General of the Navy and a number of other prominent civilian doctors, and actually got a pretty reasonable medical setup underway before we really got into the World War. Our record medically in the World War was very good, far better than we'd ever had before. If it hadn't been for the great pandemic of influenza, for which they had no answer at that time, the health record in that war would have been fine. It was the first demonstration on a large scale that an army needn't have dysentery and typhoid fever and smallpox and lockjaw. Those diseases were definitely conquered in the First World War. The treatment of wounds with the advent of aseptic surgery received a lot of impetus and was very well done indeed. Not as well done as we've achieved this war, but well done. The influenza epidemic was the only bad feature of that war. However, there were some organizational difficulties that developed then that we're still suffering from. The line officers regarded the medical department and medical care, let us say, as a sort of a commodity, and so they put it in the service of supply. We will supply you with ammunition, we will supply you with food, and we'll supply you with medical care. It still has stayed there. It's now in the Army Service Forces, and that's made for some difficulties in administration that I'll speak about a little bit later. Came World War II, in the interval between the World War, the Surgeon General's office was very markedly reorganized. Departments for the various branches of medicine were set up, and particularly there were a large number of consultants. They were called consultants to the Secretary of War. These were distinguished men, specialists in various lines, and they formed commissions like the Typhus Commission, the Malaria Commission, Tropical Disease Commission, rather, And these commissions advise the Secretary of War and the Surgeon General as to the procedures that should be followed in case of hostilities. That was a big advance. And also the tables of organization, that is, the tables by which various hospitals and other components are manned, were gone over pretty carefully. A lot of technical manuals were prepared in advance, expecting there might be a war. We had a pretty good Medical Officers Reserve Corps. Then again, we had a little warning in the previous mobilization that occurred before Pearl Harbor. First, the National Guard regiments were called in, and those doctors that are attached to the National Guard were called up. Then the reserve officers were called in, and then finally, the great bulk of doctors were called in through the Procurement and Assignment Service. The Procurement and Assignment was a new and rather unique organization. It began as a voluntary thing organized on a county basis with committees of doctors who undertook to survey every community and declare which doctor was essential to the health of that community and which would be made available for service in the Army. The draft boards recognized the recommendations of these procurement and assignment committees so that when a doctor came up for the draft, if he was deferred by the procurement and assignment, the draft board deferred him. They had two kinds of problems. They had the problem of the doctor who didn't want to go, and he was declared non-essential. Some of those doctors refused to apply for commissions when they were invited to, and they were drafted as privates in the Army. A few of them served through the war, MDs as privates in the Army. Most of them, after they got in, got over their recalcitrance a little bit and were commissioned as medical officers. But very few still served through as privates. That was... Seems to be working now. The procurement and assignment came in naturally for a lot of criticism. It had tremendous power and great responsibility. It could say to Dr. A, you stay, and Dr. B, you go. That might mean that Dr. B would die. It almost certainly meant, under the conditions that prevailed during this war, that Dr. A would make a great deal of money. It could wreck a medical school, and some medical schools maintained it did wreck them. But inevitably, under those conditions, there were criticisms. There were people who maintained there was favoritism in declaring a certain doctor essential. And there were doctors who were very resentful of the fact that they were declared essential when they wanted to go and be heroes. But I think it's only fair to say that, in general, an unpaid, voluntary organization, the Procurement and Assignment, did a truly magnificent job. They got into the Army and Navy something like 60,000 doctors before their activities were over. Word about these doctors and how they came in. The average age of the doctors that were taken in through procurement assignment at the Army Navy was about 35. They never were satisfied with the rank they got. As they say, rank rankled with them. If they were up to the age of 36 and had given no evidence of specialized training, they were commissioned then as first lieutenants. Captains, if they had specialized training. After 36, they were captains without specializations, majors afterwards. A few coy individuals who knew the right people got offered lieutenant colonelcies before they went in, and a very few actually went in with the rank of colonel. They got promoted in the due course of time sometimes. I must say that the regular Army officer, the regular Army medical officer, did a little bit better than the reserve officers in the matter of promotion. I haven't the figures for the Army at large. I have for the Air Force. At the present time, about 81% of the regular Army's officers are lieutenant colonels or colonels. 0.3% of the AUS doctors are colonels. It's a little hard to convince the AUS doctors that that's a measure of their relative professional capacity. In the matter of pay, the base pay for a first lieutenant at one end of the list was $2,000. The base pay for a colonel at the other end of the list was $4,000. There are not many generals in the medical department, three generals in the medical department of the Air Corps at the present time. When these doctors came in, they got various kinds of assignments. Generally speaking, there were two types of jobs a doctor could have. One was in the ground forces or the air forces with the troops, and the other were in either air force or ground or service of supply hospitals. If he got into a service of supply hospital, if he was a specialist, he was likely to be put in charge of one of the major professional services, chief of surgery, chief of medicine, nose and throat urology, and so forth. If he were a younger man, he was attached as a ward officer to those hospitals. The others, these men who got into the hospitals, by the way, had a pretty good time of it, professionally speaking. These hospitals were well equipped. They had pulled in a number of very good specialists, and so the training that was available for the younger men was really excellent. Those doctors that got assigned to the troops, however, to the battalions or to squadrons of Air Force, had a very thin time of it professionally. The peculiar table of organization of the Army called for 6.5 doctors per 1,000 men. That was never quite attained, but it almost was, which meant that there was one doctor for every 160 men. Well, now the best we've ever been able to do in civilian life is about one doctor to 900 people. And here we had one doctor for every 160 healthy young adults living under the very best of conditions as far as health was concerned. Naturally, there wasn't enough to do. They got terribly bored and pretty fed up with everything. They resented the fact that there was no proper rotational system worked out so they could get in the hospitals and get a little medicine again. They were quite an unhappy lot at various times. I remember one of them, and it was typical of the state of mind they would get into at a little remote station out in the Assam Valley with an air outfit that never got sick, and whenever they got badly sick, they were sent off to a hospital. The wounded never came because in the Air Corps, you either get back safe or you don't get back at all as a rule. So he had nothing to do. He was sitting there when we came along. He made no recognition of us at all, didn't get up and say, how do you do, or salute, or any of these things, just stared dully off into space. And we said, Captain, how do you do? How long have you been out here? And he looked up at us sort of vaguely and said, oh, sir, I don't know, and they won't tell me. Represented the things that happened to a good many of these doctors out on the line. In spite of all which, these doctors were a wonderful outfit. I saw something of the doctors in the First World War. These were incomparably better. It's a tribute to the type of medical education that's gone on in the last 20 years. These boys were magnificently trained. They would come into the hospital into an Army hospital, fresh out of some civilian hospital. You'd put them to work at any kind of a complicated examination, and you'd find they did it exceedingly well. They didn't require any supervision. As a matter of fact, I was supposed to be chief of professional services. I spent most of my time learning new tricks from these youngsters who'd come into the Army and profited by it to no end. I think it's fair to say that although we had some wonderful breaks in the matter of scientific progress, that the medical achievements of this war, and they're truly wonderful, are largely attributable to the type of young men who came into the Army. They were wonderfully trained, very devoted, conscientious, and hardworking youngsters. In the line of achievements, I think it might mention a few of them in detail. The overall mortality in this war may surprise you in relation to civilian mortality and others. We've been at war almost 4 years now. Only 12,000 people in this vast army have died of disease in these almost 4 years of war. Less than 1 in 1,000. Now that compares with the World War, about 16 per 1,000 died. Spanish War, it was about 29. Civil War, 65. In the Civil War, in both armies, for instance, 336,120, see, I remembered that figure, died of disease in the Civil War, as compared with 12,000 who died in disease in this war. And in the Mexican War, they lost a third of the army. A mortality, when you think of the vast number of troops and the places where they served, in the most unhealthy parts of the world, to realize that only 12,000 of those soldiers died is a tribute to the overall medical care. Certain special problems were met. Take the matter of immunizations. The Army worked out by means of the large-scale operations that were possible. Immunizations for a lot of diseases, typhoid, paratyphoid, dysentery, typhus, yellow fever, cholera, plague. For all of those, there's a pretty good immunization. Even now for influenza that has threatened us 2 or 3 times in this war and was such a disaster in the last war, a very promising, I might say, immunization has been worked out for influenza. That is going to be of great benefit to civilians in the future, this whole immunization program. Malaria was an army headache, literally. Malaria is by all means the most important disease in the world. 200 million people get it every year, and about 2 million people die. It staggered the Army at first, when we first went into the South Pacific under those incredibly, fantastically difficult conditions of steaming jungle with water and puddles and pools and streams everywhere, and Japs shooting at you every time you started out to put oil on the streams, made the control of malaria difficult. In addition to that, we had a pretty tough time with some of the generals and the colonels. They were hard put for personnel. They wanted everybody out shooting. They didn't have much patience with keeping people behind to do malaria control. As a result of that, in our first ventures into the South Pacific Islands, we had as high as 80% casualties from malaria at a time. However, we learned very rapidly. Thank God the Japs got all the quinine. We had no quinine, so we had to turn to Atabrin. That was not a misfortune at all. On the contrary, it was a great benefit, because Atabrin turned out to be a far better drug than quinine. We discovered after a while that if you give a person a little tablet of Atabrin every day, he would turn yellow, but he wouldn't get malaria. And later on, when he stopped the Atabrin, he might have some flare-ups of Vivax malaria. Probably the falciparum, which is the worst kind, would be cured. By means of Atabrin, DDT spraying, and all kinds of malaria control, we finally got the malaria down till it was less than 1% in the very worst malarial areas in the world. When I was down in New Guinea in 44, from one end of the island to the other, I looked for malaria and saw two cases in the whole of New Guinea in possibly 50 hospitals that I visited. I expected to learn something about malaria there. By that time, it had been conquered. You had an enlisted man at breakfast. When you got up from the meal, if you didn't dip in and take your Atabrin tablet, the enlisted man would quietly remind you that you hadn't your Atabrin. They forced it down generals and everybody else. They had to take the Atabrin. The Atabrin had to overcome some obstacles. A whispering campaign went on around among the soldiers that it would cause insanity. That was exploded pretty soon. Then that it would cause impotency. I think the impotency was more due, I think, to the lack of pulchritude of the native population of New Guinea than it was to the Atabrin. That dawned on them after a while. But malaria was actually conquered. Not completely or dramatically, but by dint of hard work using everything we knew, they conquered malaria. Other diseases have been completely banished. There's been no typhoid. There's been relatively small amount of dysentery, no cholera, no yellow fever. We've been through areas where yellow fever could have been a terrific disaster, but what with insect control and yellow fever vaccination, there's been no yellow fever at all. There's been no lockjaw. Not a single case of lockjaw in all this army. 1 million men, more or less, wounded, and not a case of lockjaw. That never happened before. The immunization against tetanus with tetanus toxoid has been responsible for that. That's been another great achievement. It's incredible to think that soldiers with a dirty wound, bayonet wounds and shells, putting mud and everything, heavily infected with lockjaw, should not have more. The treatment of wounds has been a remarkable thing. If you can get a man to a hospital, the chances are that he'll live. If you can keep him alive for 2 hours in a hospital, you're almost sure he'll live from that time on. The overall figures of those that got to the very first advanced hospital, out of every 100 patients, wounded men, that is, who got to the advanced hospital, only 3 died of their wounds subsequently. That compares with about 15 who died of their wounds in the World War, and it was up to 50% and 60% in wars previous to that. Blood plasma, whole blood transfusions were responsible for saving a great many of the immediate deaths from wounds. Then the remarkable antibiotics, the sulfonamide group of drugs, and penicillin coming along was responsible for saving a lot of them from infection. The record as far as wounds were concerned was exceedingly good. Other achievements of the Army Medical Corps have been such things as the air evacuation of wounded. That was installed under great opposition. They said it was an entirely impractical thing to haul wounded by air. Well, up to date, we've hauled 1,172,000 wounded men have been hauled by air. I spent a good deal of time helping set up the air evacuation service in the Air Corps, and one of the most stimulating, inspiring things I ever saw happened down at Palau when that terrible battle was going on. These soldiers were taken off by air right under the guns of the enemy. I traveled with several loads of Marines and soldiers who had been wounded, had their emergency dressings, and this was Monday night, and they were going to be in San Francisco Thursday morning. They were the happiest boys you ever saw. To think that they were going home, go home so soon. The saving in morale, the lack of suffering from that cause was extraordinary. It was a very interesting thing in connection with their evacuation to see the reaction of insane patients. There was fairly high incidence of that in some theaters. They'd be quite wild. Maybe they weren't so crazy after all. But they'd get on an airplane and start going home. They'd quiet down right away and go to sleep. Sometimes for the first time they'd slept in 10 days. They knew they were on the way home. That brings up a situation in the Army where possibly we didn't do so well. But it was a hard problem. They tell a story in the Army about a soldier who, every time they lined up in formation, would break out of formation and scurry around looking for something. And in his barracks, he'd get up at night and tear the mattress apart, and he'd look everywhere. And they said, "What are you looking for?" "He's always looking for a piece of paper." So they sent him to the hospital, and he wouldn't stay in bed. He was looking in the latrine and under the bed and everything, always looking for a piece of paper. And one day they saw him, very happy, perfectly calm, collected, all settled down. And they said, "Well, how is it? You're better now." "Yes," he said, "I got that piece of paper." And that was the certificate of medical discharge. That group of patients, ranging on one end from the gold brick, the Mullinger, on the other side to the frankly insane, was the worst problem we had in the Army. It was not unanticipated. The incidence of insanity in the country, as you all know, is very high. 1/4 of all the hospital beds in California before the war were occupied by an insane person. Naturally, the Army got its due percentage of those individuals. The frankly insane were not such a trouble as the so-called NP, the neuropsychiatric or the psychoneurotics. They came under all kind of guises. In the last war, you know, we called them shell shock. In this time, we called them simple adult maladjustment, operational fatigue, anxiety reaction, fear reaction, and various other names, including psychoneurosis. And the numbers were very considerable. Attitudes towards them changed. At first, when the manpower was stringent, the command was inclined to be very tough. They were inclined to follow such procedures as the Russian Army, for instance, which doesn't recognize there is any such condition. If a man doesn't fight, he gets shot, so there. On the other extreme was the attitude of certain psychiatrists that said nobody was a gold brick. There were no Mullingers. And if a man was too tired to march, he was sick, or his mother hadn't brought him up properly, or he'd had some catastrophe, psychic trauma in youth. And they would take these boys and coddle them in the hospitals. And they would spend months in the hospital getting fat and have no symptoms until they went out and started to march again. And they'd say, "Oh, my poor aching back." Well, we had both extremes in the care of these individuals. A great deal was done. We've got a great deal to learn about that. I would be the last one to affirm that we made a brilliant success of the care of the psychoneurotic. But we did make some contribution. We did develop in the Army this convalescent rehabilitation service. You'll hear a great deal of that in connection with veterans and civilians. It's a rather new thing, starting with the assumption that no one is ever really crippled. And legless and armless and blind and deaf are rehabilitated by various ingenious systems of training. That has been one of the most humanitarian things we've done in this war. And I think we'll see it elaborated in civilian and particularly in the Veterans Bureau after this war. We won't be left with a crop of incorrigible, incurable pensioners from this war that we had from the last. So much for what the doctors did for the Army. And I want to reiterate that I think that was largely done because the Army had an exceedingly fine group of prospects in their doctors. We might look for just a moment on what the Army did to the doctors, and that's a different story. There, some of them are pretty unhappy. Those fellows who sat for a long while with very little to do and no professional opportunity didn't like it. They couldn't understand why they were called frantically into the Army, and then, as one outfit I know, spent 8 months in military training before they saw their first patient. They couldn't understand why they were sent to what was supposed to be a busy sector of war and found the war had moved out 1,500 miles from them, and they were never moved up, sat there month after month. That was due to this same faulty organization that I spoke of in the beginning. The Surgeon General, as the General of the Surgeon of the Army Service Forces, had no control over medical personnel once they got into the other services or got into the theater of operations. There, the theater's commander-in-chief could hold on to these men. They couldn't get them out of there. Every theater commander-in-chief wanted to keep his medical department fat so it would be prepared for any emergency and did so. And it was just in the last few months that that was corrected. It was a fundamental organizational mistake and was responsible for a lot of unhappiness on the part of the doctors. This, what you might call not occupational fatigue, the soldiers had, but non-occupational fatigue on the part of the doctors was a most prominent symptom of dissatisfaction. Financially, the doctors got pretty badly hurt. Their average income in the Air Corps was about $4,000, and the Air Corps was luckier than the rest of the Army because most of them had flight pay, which is a cause of a good deal of discomfiture on the part of Army Ground Force and Service Force doctors. While they were having their financial difficulties keeping up insurance programs and all the rest, their colleagues at home were making plenty of money, and they knew it. You will find very little sympathy expressed for the hard-working doctor back home on the part of the Army doctor. They envy him his hard work and his ability to see patients, and also they envy him the money he was making because they suffered pretty seriously that way. The Army killed a lot of doctors. The casualties in this war among officers were disproportionately high to any other war that we've had, and the medical officers shared in that. On Iwo Jima, for instance, in the first five waves of troops that went ashore, every single man in the medical detachment, that is, medical corpsmen and doctors, were wounded. And every doctor that went ashore in the first 3 days was killed. That happened in other places, too. The doctors went ashore with these first waves in order to take care of the casualties immediately, and they had a very high casualty rate, mostly among the younger men. But the thing I think that they resent most is the fact that they have lacked the professional opportunities that they should have had. The danger they were willing to accept, the financial disaster that entailed was no worse than entailed any other enlisted man or other officer who went in the war, except that the doctors, as a rule, were somewhat older and had a good many more financial commitments. Out of this war, however, there are going to come some things of great benefit to the country at large. I think that we can, if we make a proper appraisal of the medical discoveries of the Army in this war, enormously benefit civilian practice of medicine. The first thing I should suggest in that way is an application of the preventive medical procedures that the Army has put into operation. We have shown for the first time how it's possible to take large bodies of troops, put into the most unhealthy of surroundings, and keep them perfectly well. And that's been done through the tropics in places where the natural incidence of disease was very high. The spraying of DDT from airplanes, for instance, with which I've had a good deal to do in the last 6 or 8 months, is going to completely transform the economics of the tropics. Places like New Guinea, vast areas, fertile soil, have been quite uninhabitable for man because of the insects. 90% of the diseases down there, insect-borne. That country can be quite economically sprayed from the air with DDT. The insects eradicated, the disease wiped out, and made a perfect treasure house as far as production is concerned. Might buy me a little land in New Guinea if I had something to buy it with after the Army salary. That is one of the things that's going to be a byproduct of the war. The organization of medical care. We've learned a lesson from that. I think it's quite apparent that the government has to go into the medical business on a very wide scale, the care of the veterans and all the other medical activities of the government, in addition to what we've done in war and what we'll have to do to keep our troops going for some time, seems to demand some sort of an integrated overall health service for the country. A place as a cabinet minister of health, or a minister of public welfare is being talked about in Washington very extensively at the present time, and I understand with a good deal of sympathy as far as the administration is concerned. Venereal disease that the Army did very well with. The Army in this war refused to accept the notion that venereal disease was inevitable and put on a strenuous campaign to keep the rates down. It was made a command responsibility, and it's been demonstrated that you can get the rates down. In the Western Flying Training Command, we got the rate down, as a matter of fact, to 2 at one time. That's 2 per 1,000 per year. That was at a time when the overall army rate was 40 per 1,000 per year. The advent of penicillin undid a little of that. It didn't take very long. Penicillin cures gonorrhea in 24 hours and syphilis in a week. And the soldiers soon got wise to that, and they relaxed their precautions somewhat. It shows that fear had some part to play in it. I recall one attitude is symptomatic of one young flying officer who came in with a pretty bad case. And in 24 hours, under penicillin treatment, he was perfectly well. He said, "Doctor, am I cured?" And I said, "Yes, you're completely cured. You're well." "Well," he said, "in 24 hours, I said, "Yes." He says, "It ain't no sin anymore, is it?" That very thing has increased the rate. The rate has gone up again in the last year. Another thing has been, and we might as well recognize it as citizens, there has been an enormous increase in gonorrhea in the civilian population. There's been a tremendous breakdown in social barriers, as some of you may have suspected from what you see going on. That has seeded the country with gonorrhea to the extent that it's never had before. However, with the weapons we have for its control and their demonstrated effectiveness in the Army, we have yet to see a case of gonorrhea in the Army that penicillin won't cure, and very few cases of syphilis that won't be cured. It's quite apparent that we can wipe these diseases out. These Army doctors are coming back. They're going to want jobs, but most of all, they're going to want training. Out of the 21,000 questionnaires we sent out, 17,000 of them said they wanted to go back in the hospital for more advanced medical training. We've got to provide some way for them to continue their interrupted medical care. They discovered by the rank of the Army and also things how important it is to be a specialist these days. The day of the old country practitioner is really over with as far as the Army doctor's concerned. They all want to be specialists of one kind or another. I foresee that after their associations in Army hospitals, they'll go in for group practice to a much greater extent than they did. There's a danger that they may form a group of ex-service doctors and that they will be somewhat out of sympathy with those who didn't serve, a sort of American Legion of doctors. I think that would be a sad mistake. Remember, though, there are 60,000 of them in the Army. There are only about 90 to 100,000 of the doctors outside, and they're getting older. So that's a factor to be reckoned with. However, that's part of the problem that we've got to look forward to for the future. We've got this war over, and it was a great achievement. I don't know how you feel. I feel a tremendous glow of elation. After knowing the sad state the country was in 1942, seeing this tremendous victory against two of the most formidable enemies we've ever had, I have tremendous pride and tremendous confidence in the future of this country. I feel that if we apply the productive ability that we showed in building all these aircraft and munitions of war, if we apply the scientific brains that had its demonstration in the Big Bang that went off in Hiroshima on the 6th of August, that we can organize this country again on a level that has never been dreamed of for human beings before. I really think that out of this war and from the lessons of this war, we actually can finally have the golden age of humanity. We only have to look forward with confidence, determine that this shall not be again, apply the things in peace we applied in war. We are undoubtedly the greatest country the world has ever seen. Nobody's going to pick on us again in a hurry. They've had their lesson this time about picking on defenseless Uncle Sam. What we must do now is take these same great qualities, convert them to the purposes of peace, and we will initiate the greatest age humanity's ever had. Thank you.